Hello, and welcome to The Musical Activist. I'm Sarah Nichols. I'm a pianist and composer, and I wanted to find out how, as a musician, I can respond to the headline that we've got 12 years to save the planet. Professor Craig Hutton, and he is a Professor of Sustainability Science at the University of Southampton. Thank you for being with us, Craig.
That's my pleasure.
So I do have to apologise to listeners because Craig, I'm afraid, is on my phone next to the computer because the internet has not blessed us today. So, you know, recording quality is as it is. But Craig, can you tell us in your job, in your research, what you do? What are you researching? What's your sort of area?
Yeah, so I often say to people that by the end of my career, I'd like to know what my job title means. only because sustainability is one of those broad areas. And, you know, it's one of those big words that's emerging and it can mean many things. But what I'm involved in, if you like, is if we think of sustainability as this goal, this sort of rightly defined goal that we're interested in, that we know roughly what it looks like. It's sort of a world in balance, and we want to achieve it. I'm interested in the sort of information that practically is needed to allow, you know, people who make decisions and policy makers, and they could be in business or government or whatever, the kind of information they need to do that, the sort of balance of that. I spend most of my time working in international development. So I work in Bangladesh, coastal Bangladesh in the Delta there, India, West Africa, Southeast Asia, so Vietnam, we're doing a lot of work on at the moment. And what we're trying to do is, usually my particular interest is trying to understand how people, particularly poor rural people, how do they use the environment for their livelihoods, for their well-being, and how is that impacted by environmental changes and social changes and economic changes. So we sort of model that for governments. We produce these models of what would happen if they built a dam here, the impacts on poverty over large areas often. But I spend a lot of my time in villages, in communities, trying to understand what's important to them and what it is we should be measuring and passing back to the government.
And what are some of the changes that you're noticing more now in terms of climate change? What are the kind of key things that you're observing?
Well, I mean, we are seeing them. I mean, we've seen them. I've been doing this for 25 years, and it was mentioned early on. You know, people in communities would note that, you know, there are bigger floods or bigger issues happening. And over those 25 years, it's gone from being an issue to, in some cases, the issue. And, you know, in coastal Bangladesh, for example, you're seeing bigger storms, not necessarily more, but certainly very powerful storms. You're seeing larger flooding occurring, you're seeing, which brings salt into the area. You're seeing substantial amounts of damage from flooding coming from rivers, where you've had extensive rainfall in the monsoonal rainfall, high-intensity monsoonal rainfalls. You're also seeing slightly more insidious things, things you wouldn't normally think about, but like late monsoons. We forget that literally hundreds of millions of farmers around the world have always rely on rain-fed agriculture. And the arrival of the rains and being able to predict when they arrive is crucial for them to actually grow their food. And if the monsoons are becoming less predictable, as they are, if you like, the system's becoming charged up and therefore sometimes it's late, sometimes it's early, high intense, that actually disrupts their agricultural calendar. So it's the disruption that we're seeing, as well as the big hazards, flood, drought, and all the things you hear. Mm-hmm. But it's the big disruptions in people's livelihoods, which means they sometimes are no longer, these are very marginal livelihoods, they're sometimes no longer viable.
I suppose I want to know how we get from their lived experience on the ground through to you sort of creating these models, and then what happens to the models. Can you maybe sort of talk us
Yeah,
through
sure.
it? I'm sort of interested in that pathway of information because obviously you're observing right up close, but then you're able to do
Yeah.
something quite powerful with those observations potentially.
And it is a pathway, that's the right word to use. So let's say, the British government will come to us in some form. We will and say, look, here's some money for people to do this kind of work, and we'll apply for that. Say, we would like to do this in Bangladesh. So you apply for that. And when you've, in that process, you will liaise with governments, and let's say we're in Bangladesh, academics and universities in Bangladesh, you'll talk to big NGOs, and you'll form a consortium, a partnership with them. Now, with that group, we will then go into communities, we will sample communities, we use maps a lot, so we create these online computer maps using, satellite imagery and all sorts of other background information. And we identify major livelihood groups where people are farming, where they're fishing, where they're maybe doing aquaculture. And we go in and talk with those people or conduct large surveys of those people, and we learn about their lifestyle, what it is that they do, their livelihoods, how these people use what are called ecosystem services. So how do they use the environment? And that might be for getting shrimp out of the river, it might be agriculture, it might be that they have shrimp in ponds, they may use the landscape for livestock. We want to understand how they use that. And what we do is interview them and try to understand them, and we'll produce something, and I've just been teaching some of my students this, we'll produce a sort of flow diagram of the relationships, the complex relationships, and they are immensely complex. They involve gender, they might involve caste systems if you're doing this in India, they'll involve wealth and age, and you're trying to understand how the community functions. And once you build this sort of model of how the community functions, you say, well, here's a typical community in this region, here's a typical community in this region. And we might then perturb that, say, what will happen to their livelihood with climate change? We look at the history of how it's changed and how it might go forward. And we sort of look at, well, their crop production might drop by 70% here, they're more likely to migrate to get other kind of livelihoods, they're going to have to do more fishing, they're going to have to do X and Y, or go into the mangrove to find food. And we talk to them a lot, this can take years, and we build this kind of model. That's what we take to the policymakers and say, okay, if you were to build a dam here, or you change this land use pattern here, we can map out the effects that will have on poverty, the effects it will have on the livelihoods of these people in quite a complex way, using large computer systems. My interest is that first bit, trying to understand how that function, how those communities function, how they might link to big industrial activities that are going on nearby or agricultural activities. And then we have to talk with the stakeholders and start showing them the outcomes of the model, getting them to think about, are the policies for climate change that they're implementing, are they right? Are they the right ones? Will they achieve the right goals? And, there's always winners and losers. We map out saying, if you do this simple thing, you build a dam here, you think it's simple, it will achieve this, but what you don't know is these people down here will suffer, and these people here. We're actually showing it to them, trying to use these models. Output.
That's
And we have to
amazing.
model climate change. Sorry.
No, well, it's amazing. And I suppose I want to ask, do governments listen?
Well, that's a really good question. And it's a question for here because, we work in the UK sometimes doing that. We've got, I'm working, today, our group is doing an interview to hope to be funded to do one on the whole of the British food system, a very large project doing exactly this kind of modelling to see if we can work with adolescents to change the plant-based diet because of the sort of climate and health context of that. Do they listen? Well, you have to work exceedingly hard right from the beginning to engage with the right stakeholders. So you spend it, you know, we know Bangladesh well, so we know who to talk to. But when we first arrive, we have to link up with local Bangladeshi academics and NGOs. This is true of all the countries we work in. And they will introduce us to government people. But the real key here is, and academics have got this wrong in the past, we're getting better at it, is we don't just turn up and say, here is our answer. Here's what we think you should do. We're not, we can always be in danger of being a solution that then goes looking for a problem. You have to listen to what they do in their day job. So we have loads and loads and loads of stakeholder meetings where we say, what do you do? What is it you're required to do? What are the policies? We analyze their policies. What would be helpful to you? And as long as you keep pushing that, they become interested because, frankly, they don't want to, they don't have time to do anything that their boss hasn't asked them to do. So, you know, they've got a job. And this is the reality. You have to understand what will, the only reason they'll engage with you is if they say, that is useful. That helps me make a decision I'm required to make. And what you'll find is a few people will really latch on. And you just have to work hard at making those people the right people who are influential. That's a very difficult task. And you know, it takes years to do. We cultivated those relationships in countries so that people listen. And we run our models in Bangladesh. And, you know, we've been influential and we're, to some degree, on huge investments, billions of pounds worth of investments. We've done a little bit where we think they should do things differently. It's always hard to finally know what it is you've achieved. It's a very difficult process to untangle where you may have helped.
I'm really fascinated that you mentioned that today you'd been working on the British food system. And I think you said, thinking about trying to get adolescents to consider a plant-based diet. Is that what you said?
Yes,
that's right. Yeah. So, because it just struck me, the sort of hugely disparate nature of how a poor rural community in Bangladesh is living off what you called ecosystem services. In other words, basically living in harmony with nature to survive.
Well,
or not.
Maybe not enough, but yes, right. they're living off nature. Yes, that's
right. But then how, what's the comparison? Like, how are we doing, I suppose? Sorry.
Well, I mean,
I find that really interesting.
What's interesting about it is, you know, it is a very different world of the actual detail. And, you know, all my life I've worked in the developing world, Africa and Asia. But what we have done is develop tools and methods. So what we're doing, and this is really the first time we're aiming to do it, I hope we can, is we have got very good at producing those models, producing those first of all conceptual models, turning them into sort of computational models. And this can take up to 100 people. These projects are very large. You know, you've got experts in oceanography and social scientists and anthropologists, and we all work together to try to produce this understanding. It takes a lot of work. But the method is very transferable. And, you know, I teach sustainability abroad, and so I have a UK interest. But what we've done is said, well, look, the approach, you still have to engage stakeholders in the same way. Government people in this country won't listen unless you can actively help them with what their job is. You still have to do the policy analysis. You still have to do the same thing. What you are passing up different information, but the methodology is very transferable. And that's, I find, quite interesting. You know, we have some outstanding experts at Southampton University in things like behaviour, health. It's one of the speciality areas. Professor Mary Barker is an adolescent behaviour and health expert, and her team, who I've linked up with, I'm interested in working with internationally, also works in the UK, and that's how I got involved. You know, their team work with psychologists on what is it about, can we leverage the environmental concern, anxiety to some extent, that is occurring to change attitudes towards food, particularly, you know, in a difficult group. Sometimes adolescents, you know, health is not a big driver. Adolescents feel sort of immortal sometimes, but some of them are very concerned about the environment. And can we leverage that into behavioural shifts and championing that down with those groups, and particularly with disadvantaged groups? So I have some interest in that, for, you know, poverty issues. Plenty of poverty in this country, and I'm sort of much more aware of that. There are groups of adolescents in this country who live in retail deserts where you can't buy healthy plant-based food, even if you wanted to. They're not exposed to it culturally. So this is about what should the government be doing? And we want to build a model that they can test their ideas on to help in that field.
So
this is sustainability, not just climate change. Climate change is a major piece of our world, but it fits into a much bigger, how do we manage the world? How do we manage these big systems? And we have to work across our disciplines in an interdisciplinary way. Sustainability scientists are the people who try to link with all these different disciplines and want to be a sort of jack of all trades. You know, it suits people who like have generalist interests and try to link in with other people.
Yes, I suppose I'm interested to sort of ask, you mentioned individual behaviour change, I mean, thinking about the adolescence and the plant-based food. And obviously, it's a big thing at the moment. People are sort of grappling with this sense of either trying to do something or feeling a bit helpless or not knowing what to do or not sure which thing really counts. And actually, I don't really want to give up that thing, thanks, because actually that's something I really like. And then the sort of huge framework shifts that might be required, literally leaving the fossil fuels in the ground. What's your sort of approach when you're trying to think about this balance between the individual and...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The respect, the position of the individual, that's a complex one. It's one I think about and talk with my students a lot about, because it really is an important thing. There's an interesting story. If you look back at how the fizzy drinks, I won't name them, industry in America in the 50s, there was a period of time when, and you may recall, I certainly do, when you would be given a glass bottle and you would take it back.
Yeah.
And that worked rather well. And what it did was incentivize us to recycle before we even thought about recycling. Somebody quite clever in the drinks company said, this is paying for us. Why don't we put it in an aluminium can and then essentially make it their problem? We will deliver it in this product, but then it's their job to dispose of that, keep it entirely, all these things, litter. There became a kind of attitude that it wasn't our responsibility anymore, the company. That did it. Now, we accepted that and got on with it, and now there's litter, and we have to recycle things, and that's become the norm. We are subject to huge inefficiencies in wrapping and plastic. We could do a lot better. We could do hugely better. Now, us recycling, in and of itself, it's actually very small effects. But the fact that we want to, and we do it almost as a gesture, and even if it is tokenistic, is hugely significant in terms of our attitude. What we have to do is we have to use our political power. We have to start changing the whole big system. And we are doing that by consumer, you know, by not buying things, by... People are beginning to see this. Markets are beginning to see it. I get a bit fed up with us all feeling super guilty. We do, and we do need to change our lives. But you and I individually can't change this system. I just will not be able to function in this society if I don't have these clothes and drive back, have to get there or use a train, or all these things. I want regulation. It's got to come. It's a democracy. We have to bring in the leaders who will then have the courage to say, do you know what? It's going to hurt, but we're going to do it. And that's why I hear again and again, people say, I want to not have the choice to do the wrong thing. The wonderful thing about that is it will drive innovation. If we regulate that you can't have this kind of plastic, you know somebody clever in a laboratory somewhere will be then invested in and will produce the product we need. I think what we need is the heavy, heavy incentivization of regulation. But we're in this position where people are being made to feel guilty, and that allows some big corporations to get away. It's your fault. It's not our fault. It's your fault. Well, no. I think we need you to innovate around this problem and to really drive change. And that will only occur when we either don't buy their products, that's difficult, because we buy them indirectly or directly, but if we get the heavy regulation and we buy into that in a big way. And, you know, the Gretas are driving that. They're scaring the corporations into it. They're scaring governments into it. And I'm all for that. They're thinking, well, hang on, people might start voting for this thing. And that's when things change. Got to vote to the right people, I'm afraid. Or say, if you don't do this, we will vote you out. It's got to become like economics. It's one of those subjects that's not you either want it or you don't. There's left economics and right economics. Essentially, it's a thing that must be done. Yes. The environment is a thing that must be done. It's not just the left own it or the right. It's a thing that all parties and all politics and all governments must say, well, we have to get this right. And I think that's the big push.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's just nice sort of sitting, listening to someone talking sense.
Well, okay, I mean, to be honest, it's easier to talk sense and not, I mean, when you're actually, if you were actually in government, and I know a few people, but it is difficult. The pressure's on you.
So that's an interesting question, isn't it? Why don't they, you know?
Well, because I suppose if you're, the difficulty is that it might cost jobs. Look at COVID now, you know, the balancing act between health and in theory is just locked down, of course. But we know that livelihoods are about people. And, you know, if you destroy the economy, if you say, do you know what, we're going to go green and we don't care about the impact on the economy, what you could drive is incredible poverty in some sectors.
Why does going green mean trashing the economy? I mean, what about somebody like Kate Raworth? What about donut economics? What about, you know, different ways of using economics to support good societal decisions?
That can be done very well. I'm a big supporter of the green plan, you know, the green economic planning. We need that. But what you have to be very careful of is in, say, a local council, if you say, okay, we're going to spend all our money on recycling, which was done in one area, it actually resulted in some money being taken away from other sectors, like healthcare, because there's a limited budget. So there is a reality. When you talk to an actual politician, they can say, I really want to be green. But when you say be green, we want to do this, we want to do that. But actually, if I do that, I'm taking money away from it. So we have to progressively move our economy. But actually, there will be pain. There will be some pain. I don't think it's possible. But if we do it right, there may be perfectly valid growth. There may be, you know, real vibrant jobs that go into the future. This is a kind of transition which will have some pain.
Yes.
But we could result in a sustainable economy. It is possible. It's just any time you shift it at all. You'll never see fear in the face of the Prime Minister compared to if you say this will nudge up unemployment or this will, you know, they're like, because it, the balancing act between people's livelihoods, health, education, trying to move it is incredibly complicated. So I have certain sympathy. It's not me having to make the difficult decisions, but we are going to, you know, I can stand on the sideline and say, this is the decision I think we should make. And I do advise.
What did you say? Sorry, I didn't catch that bit. Can you just say it again?
Sorry, I mean, it's easier for me sitting on the sidelines offering advice to governments.
Sure.
And saying, well, I think you need to, you know, cut your investment in the oil sector there, so jobs going, and quickly build up jobs in wind turbines. Or, you know, you could be saying something along those lines. And then they say, yeah, but it'll take 5 years. What are we going to do with those people? There are some realities. And I think what we have to be is constructive. We have to work with governments and agencies to say, as long as you've got goodwill to do this, we can navigate a pathway. Mm. We accept that it isn't tomorrow. We can't just transfer it because the economy, people matter. They need to be paid every day, if you'd like. We have to really carefully map out pathways. In a way, that's part of why we try to do this modelling. Mm. Because it's a sophisticated tool which allows you to try and work out the pathways through. Mm. I really, you know, we've got to do it. It's not a simple process. Mm. But I do believe fully that we can have a green, sustainable economy. There is absolutely no economic reason why, if we could magic ourselves to it, you know, straight away you could have people employed in all those sectors.
Yeah.
The difficult part is the getting over that hump of transition and change and winners and losers in that. We've got a lot of poor people in this country as it is. You know, we've got to be very careful of that.
There's one last question which I'd just like to ask, which is, what do you feel about people misusing the word sustainability?
Label, do you mean?
Yeah, sort of people saying, oh, this is, you know, sustainable, blah, blah, whatever, and actually you discover...
Well, I have, like environment, you remember sort of 20 years ago, everything was called environment. It's just, you know, every van had environmental services, and what they meant is they'll change your windows, which is fine, you know. I think sustainability has done the same thing, but that can make you grind your teeth a bit and say, people misusing it. But what I think I've seen is that sometimes that is the precursor to deeper cultural change.
Hmm.
So you start by, you know, people saying environment, this, that, and the other, greenwashing, people starting. And that used to make me very angry. But actually, it seems to be almost sometimes, if the push keeps coming, if it keeps rising and driving, it's almost a requirement of pre-structuring society to accept large changes. It's almost like we talk about it a lot first. Then we begin to kind of colour it in a little around us. Then we begin to invest in it. Then it begins to grow. It strikes me that it's sort of, because I did used to get very fed up with people using it all the time. But it does mean we're thinking about it all the time. Mm. Even companies, I get cross when companies say they're in sustainable environment and they're not. You know, they've got, you know, eventually people will see that. But the fact that they know that it sells means that they know people care.
Mm.
And it begins to generate a momentum, even if there is some annoyance behind it. I've come to realise it may be necessary, a necessary vanguard to changing in a deep cultural way. And for the last 5 years, you know, I really feel we've changed culturally in about the environment. Actually, we changed culturally about sustainability. And, you know, when I say sustainability, I mean all the way from Black Lives Matter to, you know, the social issues in gender to, you know, all of these things are actually about how we are as a society.
Yes, well, it sounds like you're sort of talking about societal growing up, really.
Yes, I often think we're a teenage society where we have a lot of power and very little understanding of the impacts of that power. We're kind of like a slightly naughty teenager society where we've got a lot of muscle but don't really understand the social context of what we do. Yes, we've got power, but we're not wise yet.
Mm.
And we've got to become wiser that these things are all connected. That's why, you know, when people talk about climate change to me, I always say, yes, it's about sustainable management of the whole planet. It's one aspect of a very complicated system we're going to have to engage in that is right the way across from social justice to types of economic growth to how do we want to see the environment in 200 years' time? Mm. And I mean 200 years' time. What will it look like? Because it's taken an awfully long time to do it. And you can tell I'm an academic. I'm sort of wandering around.
I keep thinking about, there's a book by Jonathan Porritt called The World We Made. Do you know it?
I haven't read it, but I've heard of it.
I'm sort of thinking, yeah. You know, I just keep thinking about it, so I just thought I'd mention it. We should wrap up now, but thank you so much. We can add a list of references to this recording, you know, if there's any like quick links that you think people might like to go and just dip into. But meanwhile,
something a bit lighter than the rest. Well, I don't know, some of them might be interesting, but yeah. You know, we've got some free stuff on that.
We can do that over email. But for now, we're going to be talking on Saturday, the 10th of October, after the Anvil show. And really looking forward to speaking to you then. Thank you so much for being involved in the tour. It's brilliant to hear you.
I enjoy it. And you know, me and my colleagues do this as much as we can, as often as we can, because I think it's part of what we ought to be doing. You know, it really is part of what we should be doing.
Thank you very much for speaking to us today, Craig.
Absolutely fantastic. Really appreciate it.
Please book at sounduk.net. I'm speaking to Craig on Saturday, the 10th of October, after the show hosted by The Anvil in Basingstoke. So maybe see you there. Thank you.